about Phillips received his PhD in astrophysics from Cornell University, and then his master's divinity here at Biblical Seminary, and has done a Master of Arts degree in Hebrew in the American Institute of Holy Land Studies. He's been interested in the subject of a aged earth for some years, and particularly last spring, when he and I were up in the Poconos debating a couple of younger men on a particular subject. So we're happy to take him on the seat.
Thank you very much. Tonight we saw an example of Murphy's Law, which says anything that can go wrong will go wrong. There's a corollary to that, however, and that is that the object which is not working will fix itself just before the man with the separate equipment arrives on the scene. Basically, what I wish to discuss tonight are some very interesting scientific evidences which lead me to believe that the Earth and the universe are much older than 10 to 20,000 years. The age of the Earth is one of these enduring discussions that you find in Christendom. There's some individuals who read the scripture and are convinced that the Earth and the universe were created in 6 literal days, and that the Earth and the universe are only 18,000 years old, 10 to 20,000 years old. There are other Christians, however, who also believe in the inerrancy and infallibility of scripture, who read the scripture and feel that the Earth, that the scripture itself does not necessitate that the Earth is 2,000 years old, and allow for scientific evidence which supports that the universe is something like 10 to 20 billion years old, and that the Earth itself is maybe anywhere between 4.5 to about 5 billion years old. I'm of the latter variety, but as I mentioned in my little blurb, I'm not going to attempt tonight to show that the universe is billions of years old. All I wish to do tonight is show some evidence of that the universe is more than 10 to 20,000 years old. And the reason I want to do this is to try to relate to people who feel that the universe is young, to try to show them that there's evidence out there that needs to be accounted for if indeed the universe is only 2,000 years old. And I want to do this by showing a couple very interesting evidences from astronomy, and then show about 3 evidences from geology, evidences that show that the Earth is really much older than 2,000 years. At the end, we will have a time for questions, but any time during the discussion, if there is something that I'm saying which is not clear, please feel free to raise questions. I will repeat the questions for the sake of the microphone, and then we will continue. Well, the first evidence from astronomy has to do with light travel time. Here's what I mean by that. As we go out into the backwoods in order to be able to see anything in the sky, we look at various objects in the sky, and we see those objects by virtue of the fact of the radiation that is emitted by them, by the light that is emitted by them. And that light travels at a finite speed, about 186,000 miles a second, and it takes a certain amount of time for the light which is emitted by an object in the heavens to reach us. The time that it takes depends on the distance to the object. We feel that, we mean astronomers, we feel that we can find the distance to objects in the universe fairly accurately. By that I mean objects that are maybe 1, 10, 100 million light years away. We feel that we know those distances fairly accurately. Various ways in which an object, the distance to an object is measured. And basically, we use the term light year to account for how far an object is. A light year may sound like a time, a measurement of time. In reality, a light year turns out to be a measurement of distance, and that distance is the distance that light travels in 1 year. At 186,000 miles a second, that distance turns out to be about 6 trillion miles in 1 year. But astronomers, being the sort of people who don't like to write a lot of zeros after figures, instead of saying that a certain object is so many trillions of miles away, it is very easy just to say that it is 1 light year away. The nearest star is about 4 1/3 light years away, meaning it takes light about 4 1/3 light, 4 1/3 years to get here. As we go out to more distant objects, we find that the distance goes out millions, in some cases billions of light years. What it means is that if the object is really, in this particular case, of a diagram, 1 million light years away, means it would take 1 million years for the light to reach us. If it takes 1 million years for the light to reach us, then what you have is a universe that is at least 1 million years old. In other words, the argument would be that if I can measure the distance of an object as 1 billion light years, the light took 1 million years to travel from that object to me, therefore the universe must be at least that old. Ah, somebody argued. Could it be that the universe is really only a few thousand years old, and when the Lord created the star, he also created the light on the way from this particular star to the earth? Here's the problem with that. Suppose we have this object that's 1 million light years away, but in reality, the world, the universe is only about 20,000 years old. What we have is the following situation. If the star was created 20,000 years ago, then light that would be given off from that star will only have traveled this much instead of the whole distance of 1 million light years. Basically, it would have traveled 20,000 light years as opposed to 1 million light years. The light, however, that we are receiving, that was created on the way from the star, if indeed that is what occurred, this light contains information about the object that we are observing. What kind of information might this have? Well, basically, information about the mass of the object, how much material is there, size of the object, but more important, any variability in the object. The light that comes to us from an object is basically the memory tape of what has occurred to the object. In short, the star is undergoing certain processes, or any other object that we may be observing is undergoing certain processes, and the light that is given off by that object is, in effect, the memory bank of what has happened. And so this light train, which I've represented in blue, that is traveling 1 million miles, basically contains the history of what has occurred at this particular object. However, if the object is 1 million light years away, and the age of the universe is only 20,000 years, the light that we are receiving here on Earth really does not represent a true history of what is occurring at the star. Rather, it represents fictitious history. In short, any information that I receive from this blue train of light that is coming from the star is not telling me what the star is doing at present. It is telling me what the star would have been doing 1 million years ago. However, if the star is only 20,000 years old, in effect, the history is fictitious history. The history that is inherent in the light beam that is coming from the star is not telling me what the star was actually doing 1 million years ago because the star wasn't around. This concept of the fictitious history is what bothers me most about the idea that God created the universe, created objects that are far away, and also created the light from those objects coming from the object down to Earth. The reason that has trouble with that is, again, because the light that we receive, the information that we receive from that light, would be fictitious if indeed the object isn't at least as old as, or the universe isn't at least as old as it takes the light to get from the star to the Earth. Let me give you a biblical example here. I think all of us would agree that Adam was created mature. Now, whether he was a late teen, early 20s, whatever it may be, I think we would all agree that Adam was not created 3, 4, 5 years old. Certainly Eve was not. On the other hand, let us assume Adam was created at about 25 years old, what he would look like if he were 25 years old. Would Adam have a memory of what happened to him when he was 5 years old or 10 years old? No, he wasn't around at that time. So you would think, I would trust you to think that there is something funny about Adam being created with an age of 25 years, being created at looking that age, being only a few minutes old, and then having a memory of what occurred to him when he was a small boy, 3-4 years old. That particular memory that he would have would not be a valid memory. It would be a fictitious history, because he was not alive when he was 3 and 4 years old. Well, the same kind of thing is happening here if the life has been created on the way. And the concept, as I say, of fictitious history is what bothers me most about a creation of objects in the universe with life made to travel from the object to the earth. I have difficulties with that. And so my conclusion would be here that if we measure an object that is about a million light years away, which, by the way, is a very easy measurement to make, a very accurate measurement to make, I think we can say, if we want to avoid fictitious history, I think we can say that the universe is at least as old as in years as the object is away from us in light years. Now again, I'm not claiming that all the measurements out to billions of light years are accurate. But I don't need to go out that far. All I want to show here is that the accurate measurements that take us out maybe about 100 or 200 million light years are accurate. And if the objects are 100 or 200 million light years away, then the light has been traveling through the universe for at least that long. And therefore, the universe must be at least that long. One other thing before I go on here, some people have proposed that maybe life can take some kind of a shortcut. Maybe in space, there's some kind of a tunnel that the light can travel through and take kind of a shortcut between the object and the Earth. And even though the object is measured to be far away, perhaps the light can take some other route, which will get it here in much less time than would be implied by the distance. The trouble with that is, in my little universe, the light that travels through the universe will travel precisely along the path that you are using to make your distance measurements. In short, if the light has taken a shortcut, then the distance that you measure to the object is really going to be the distance along that shortcut. If the object is really taking a million years to get here, then the distance that you measure, the hundreds of million light years distance that you measure, is along the path of the light. And so there is no way, really, to have an object's distance measured to a million light years, and on the other hand, say that there's a shortcut and the light is really coming to us in much shorter time. The distance measurement would also show that to you. And there is no theoretical framework whereby you can get the light to tunnel through one part of space to another part of space, thereby shortening the time that the light takes to reach the Earth, even though the object may be at great distances. The idea of fictitious history, the lack of any tunneling that the light can do through the universe to reach us in a shorter time than the million light years, provides to me fairly substantial evidence that the universe is at least as old as the most distant objects that can be measured. And as I say, some of these objects are measured out to billions of light years. There's another astronomical evidence that is very interesting, and this has to do with the so-called tidal friction between the Earth and the Moon, and it works as follows. The Moon, which revolves around the Earth, exerts a gravitational attraction on the Earth. Since the front surface of the Earth is closer to the Moon than the center of the Earth, and since the center of the Earth is closer to the Moon than the more distant part of the Earth, the Moon pulls on the front surface of the Earth with a greater gravitational force than what it pulls on the center of the Earth. And that result is to pull away the surface of the Earth facing the Moon from the center of the Earth, and additionally, to pull the Earth, the center of the Earth, with a little greater force than pulling the distant face of the Earth, the face that is opposite the Moon. And that result is, since the Earth has a lot of water in it, and that result is, for the Moon to pull the water away from the Earth somewhat, and perform a bowl. If the earth was still, the bowl would face the moon. However, the earth is rotating. In this particular case, if you're looking down on top of the earth, everything is rotating counterclockwise. The moon is going around the earth counterclockwise, goes around 360 degrees in about a month. The earth, however, spins once every 24 hours on its axis. As a result of the spinning earth, this bowl that normally would line up towards the moon gets carried around. And even though the moon is producing the tides, the tidal bulges do not face the moon, but they are at a slight angle to the line between the moon and the earth. And what it means is, not only is the moon pulling on the earth, but the moon also pulls on this tidal bulge because of the gravitational effect. As a result of the pulling back of this bulge, the net effect is for the earth to slow down in its rotation rate. Because as the earth turns underneath the water and bulge, there's a certain amount of friction between the water and the earth. And over the course of many, many years, the spin rate of the earth will slow down as a result of the tide, of the tidal friction between the tides and the earth. Now, we know how much gravitational pull the moon would have on the tidal bulge. We understand the frictional effect between the tidal bulge and the earth, and so we can predict how fast the earth is slowing down. Or to put it another way, we can predict how much faster the earth was spinning in the past than what it is today. And these calculations can be made. They are strictly based on the tidal effects of the moon. And you get a graph that looks a little bit like this. Along the horizontal axis, you see the number of millions of years ago, starting out with 0, 65, 135, out to about 60 million years ago. These names that are underneath just represent different geological periods that correlate with the years that are given in numbers. And then along the vertical axis, what you find are the number of days in a year back at previous time. Now, as I said, the net effect of the moon is to slow down the spin rate of the earth. As you go into the past, the earth would have been spinning faster, and if the earth was spinning faster, what it would imply is that you would have more days in a year in the past than what you have now. With the present spin rate of the earth, we wind up having 365 and a quarter days in a year. However, if you go back a few hundred million years, I want to pick out two particular times, this time in here between 280 and 345 million years ago, and the earth was spinning faster, you'd wind up with more days in the year, and the number of days you would have in a year is around 390 days. So remember, the day-night cycle depends on the spin of the earth, and the year depends on how long it takes the earth to go around the sun. There's nothing that is slowing down the time that it takes the earth to go around the sun. That period of time has remained the same. But if you increase the number of revolutions that the earth makes on its axis, then what you will find, in effect, are more days in a year than what you have at present. And so you start here at about 365 days, goes about 390 days for this period of time, which in geological terms, it's called the Carboniferous period. You'll see why I mentioned that in a moment. And then you go in here to the Devonian period, which was down about 360 million years ago, and you find that the number of days in a year should have been about 400 some days to the year. Well, that's all great. Is there any way that we can really check to see whether this is true or not? The answer is yes. We can check to see if it is true by taking a look at some properties of corals. Corals and shellfish. I have some corals here. I'll pass them around and can examine them and see what they look like. One is a modern coral. The other is a fossilized coral. Corals and some shellfish have a very interesting property, in that they have growth rings that are very similar to the growth rings of trees. And there are particular quarrels that exist today which reflect the daily growth pattern. That is to say, during the daylight, when there is sun, the coral will grow faster than it does at night. The corals also experience a mealing growth pattern. That is to say, when the water is warmer during the summer, the corals will grow faster than when it is cooler during the winter. Both the yearly and the daily growth pattern can be seen on 7-day corals. And you can correlate the daily growth pattern with the yearly growth pattern, and you can see by the comparison that it matches for 365 days in a year. Now, the interesting thing is that there are some corals, like the one pictured here, which existed back in the Carboniferous period, and also existed back in the Devonian period, which have the same properties as 7-day corals in that they show both daily and yearly growth cycles. And when the daily cycle is compared to the yearly growth pattern, you get something that looks like this. Let me try to explain what's going on here. Along the horizontal line, again, you have the years, in millions of years. In this particular graph, however, zero starts over here to the right, and you go back in time by going from right to left. And along the vertical axis, you see the number of days in the year. The dark lines, dark solid lines that you see emanating from the lower right-hand side, give you the upper and lower limit of what the number of days should be per year as you go back in time, based solely on astronomical calculations. The solid line here. The points that you see here in the Devonian period, you see a point up on top, a point here in the middle, and a point down below, represents the range of data that we see by examining Devonian corals. And this upper dot represents the largest number of days per year that have been found, and the lowest dot represents the smallest number of days per year that have been found. And the spread of data is in between here for the Devonian period, then over here for the Carboniferous period, which represents the Pennsylvania and the Mississippi, like we saw in the previous diagram. What you find again is the highest and lowest spread of data, which represents corals, the correlation of the daily growth pattern with yearly growth pattern for the corals. Now, the interesting thing to find here is the following. First of all, no matter how spread these data are, you don't find any of the Devonian or Carboniferous corals with 365-day growth patterns. In short, all of the corals in the past show that the number of days that we had in previous years was more than the number of days that we have in our present year. Second, the spread of the data in the corals really overlaps the spread of the data from the calculations that are made strictly on the basis of astronomy. And if you take kind of the midpoint of the spread, in both of these cases, you see that the midpoint of the spread fits fairly well with the calculation. So what it implies here then is that the theory that the Earth has really been slowing down over hundreds of millions of years really has some evidence to back it. And where does that evidence come from? First of all, it comes from the corals. The corals, however, are biological. And so the physical processes that determine what the corals are doing are strictly biological processes. Corals grow, and they display the characteristics of daily and yearly growth patterns, but all that's a biological process. The calculation as to how many days there should be in a year for the past is strictly an astronomical process. What about these dates down here? How have we dated the corals? Well, we date the corals by the layers of rock in which they are found. Ultimately, the layers of rocks are dated by geological processes. And the interesting thing is, it all comes together. The astronomical calculation, which is independent of the corals, matches what the corals are doing. What the corals are doing is independent of the age calculation, that is the strata in which they are found, and all of these three physical processes come together very nicely. The biological process of the coral, the astronomical process of the tidal friction, and the geological processes, which give us the strata in which the material is found. All of these independent lines of evidence really come together, and what it means is that we have very strong evidence that the Earth has been slowing down over the course of several hundred million years. And hence the obvious conclusion is that the Earth has been around for several hundred million years for this to take place. Again, how else are you going to explain it? Well, you might say, well, this is the way it was created. Well, that's fine, but doesn't it appear somewhat peculiar that God would create it in such a way to match what turns out to be a long-term process here? That the fact that you have these three lines of evidence from astronomy, biology, and geology coming together, this argues very strongly that the Earth indeed is a few hundred million years old. The next line of evidence comes from geology, and it comes from bar clay deposits. Let me try to illustrate what bar clay deposits are. I notice that the material is layered. This layering can be broken up into two kinds of layering. First of all, you see the thicker white layer, and then you see the darker black layer. A single white band and a dark band represent 1 year. Now here's what's happening. Bar clay form the bottom of lake, and it happens for the following reason. During the spring and early summer, in the region where the lake is located, you have heavier rain. These rains wash material off the land and wash it into the lake bed, into the lake. The material settles out in the lake. Near the shore of the lake, you have coarser material that settles in the middle of the lake. The coarser material can no longer be carried by the stream when it comes into the lake, and so it's dropped behind by coarser material, I mean little pieces of rock, sand, etc. But the very, very tiny material, the clay particles, are carried out by the waters out into the middle of the lake and kind of spread out in the lake. But eventually, even these very tiny clay particles will begin to settle out of the water. The heavier clay particles will settle first. That is represented by the white band. This occurs during the spring and the summer. The dark bands that you find are formed of the tiniest clay particles. These very tiny clay particles are so tiny that the slightest motion of the water will prevent their settling. These particles have to wait until winter when the surface of the lake is frozen over, and you no longer get any interaction from the wind, which stirs up the water and keeps the clay particles in suspension. After the surface of the lake is frozen over, then the tiniest clay particles can settle down and be deposited at the bottom of the lake, and the dark bands represent, as I said, those particular clay particles. Following spring, the ice melts, the rains begin, heavier material is again carried into the lake. The heavier material gets deposited. When the lake freezes again, the lighter material, the clay particles, gets deposited on top of that. And so you have this alternating pattern of light and dark. Now, one other thing that adds evidence that this is exactly what is happening, and that each couplet, that is, each white band and dark band, really represents a year, is the fact that in the white band, you also find a lot of power that is washed in as a result of the spring and summer rains, which are not only washing in material, debris, but are also washing in pollen and plants that are forming at that particular time. The winter band, the very dark band, doesn't contain any pollen in it. That has all been precipitated out. And so when you combine that particular fact of the pollen along with what is happening in present day lakes, we see that we have a way here of enumerating how many years this particular lake was around simply by counting the number of light and dark bands. Count all the bands and divide by two, and you got the years that that lake was present where all these deposits were forming. Or if you like, just count the number of couplets, and one couplet represents a light and a dark band. Well, are there areas where certain processes in the earth have exposed these bar plates that were once in the bottom of a lake? And the answer is yes. And this has been seen in the midsection of our country. One place is in Texas, and the way these particular couplets have been found, the way this particular formation has been seen to be bar plates, has to do with the oil exploration that went on in Texas. Oil exploration involves digging boreholes, and the boreholes are constructed in such a way so that the material through which the drill passes is brought up, and you can actually see the kind of material that the geologist is boring through. That becomes important because certain kinds of rocks indicate oil, and other kinds of rocks indicate no oil. And so geologists are very, very curious to see what is under the surface of the earth by digging boreholes that go literally thousands of feet deep. Two boreholes, 15 miles apart, found the following concerning the Toledo, Castile, and Bell Canyon formation. First of all, the bar plates are 1,467 feet thick. When you count all the bands, we have 520,000 bands. Just to show you that geologists have boring work too. Can you imagine anything less exciting than sitting and counting a bunch of bands? But if you're into this, you're going to put up with that drudgery. Well, if you have 260,000 couplets, what it would imply is that the formation is at least 260,000 years old. Well, I'd say, maybe there's another explanation. After all, this is a sedimentary feature. That is to say, this is something that has been formed by sediment that has precipitated and settled out of water. Is it some other way of being able to explain sedimentary features like this? Yes. Noah's flood. Is it possible that Noah's flood gave rise to these particular layers? Well, let's think about that a little bit. First of all, Noah's flood, as we read in Scripture, was a very destructive event. You would have water washing back and forth across the earth with tremendous pressures and a tremendous force. That is not the kind of water out of which clay particles settle. Clay particles settle out of quiet water, not out of turbulent water. Well, you might say, maybe all this happened when the flood finally subsided, when the forceful part of the flood subsided, and the water was just draining away. Perhaps as the water was draining away, what it did was to wash away material from the dry land into the ocean basins and into the lake basins where the water was draining into after the flood. The problem with that is you would not get this periodic layering. Basically, the water that would be washed away from the dry land that contained this material, as this water would go into the lower areas, which you would have in a situation where all the heavy stuff would settle first, then the lighter stuff, then the very, very light stuff, to form one band on top of what has already settled rather than this alternating layer. Well, could it be, another reason why it would be difficult to believe that this kind of material was weighed down by the flood is the following. I made a little calculation here, and I say, assume Noah's flood was actively depositing sediments for 1 year, 365 days. Now, that is a generous assumption, because really the flood acted a little less than a year, and the time at which the water would have been doing its destructive activity would be less than a year. But I'm just using 365 days as kind of a rough number as to how long Noah's flood would have been depositing sediment. Now, we have 520,000 bands laid down in 365 days. And assuming now that all this was laid down in the course of a year, we ask ourselves, how fast must these bands be laid down? And it turns out, if you do the calculations, it turns out that one band a minute must be laid down. Now, this is very unreasonable for the reason I said before. Noah's flood shows water action. The water's in action. The water is hardly quiet. And as a result of the activity of the water, the light material would not settle out to begin with, let alone to have layer after layer of very fine silt that would be laid in 1 minute. Also, if Noah's flood is doing that, why is it that Noah's flood would be able to lay down a band that contains pollen, followed 1 minute later by a band which doesn't contain pollen, followed uniformly by a band which contains pollen, and then another band which does not contain pollen? In short, the whole thing just seems very unreasonable. Any other way to explain this, other than what is happening in 7 days late, really is very unreasonable. And so, I think what we can say here is that these particular bands, 520,000 bands, really represent a feature that is 216,000 years old. But that's peanuts compared to what is happening in the Green River Formation. In the Green River Formation, which spreads over 40,000 square miles, and you're basically talking about something about 200 miles on a side, a region about 200 miles on a side, 200 miles square, over 40,000 square miles, again with the boreholes, what we find is the Green River Formation. The Green River Formation contains 2,500 feet, or about 15 million bands of water. Again, alternating. Underneath the bars, underneath the 2,500 foot layer of bars, you have another 25,000 feet of sedimentary strata. Okay, so what? Well, here's the so what. According to traditional flood geology, that is to say, the concept that sedimentary strata and sedimentary rocks were formed by the flood, by Noah's flood in 1 year, if you have 25,000 feet of sedimentary strata below the 2,500 feet of bar clay, basically what you have is 2,500 feet of material that you have to account for with Noah's flood. Somehow that material has to be laid there over the course of 1 year. Again, the time that you need for the duration of the flood. What it amounts to, again, if you do the mathematics, is that about 75 feet of sediment per day was laid down. I mentioned before that being generous and allowing the flood to work over a year, if the flood really worked less than a year, then you would have to lay down more than 75 feet of sediment per day. So let's say 75 feet of sediment was laid down, which would include the sedimentary layers below the bars and the bars themselves. When you calculate how many bars layers there are in 75 feet, and then check to see how many barbed layers would be laid down then in a day, it comes out that you have to lay down about 5 bands per second. That's worse than the 1 per minute. Now, so again, to lay down 5 bands per second of material that needs very quiet water to precipitate out of, again, just seems very unreasonable. The math just doesn't add up. And so again, what I would argue is that the 15 million bands that you find in the Green River Formation represents a feature that is about half that, 7.5 million years old. But that ain't all. Here's something else that you find in some of the strata that exist below the bar clay. Flamingo bones, also there are some crocodile bones there. There are some flamingo footprints. There are nesting sites, fossilized nesting sites, that represent, or I should say that appear exactly the same as the present day nesting sites that you find in East Africa flamingos. You also find the coprolites, the fossilized species that match the species of present day flamingos. So, what does it mean? What it means is, the strata below, what you have is a population of flamingos that were there for enough time to build nests, raise their young. One thing I did not mention here is that also fossilized eggshells have been found at these sites.
And so what you find in these sedimentary layers, what you find are fossilized flamingo nesting sites, which means, again, the flamingo must have had time to build a nest, lay the eggs, hatch the eggs, raise its young, have time to take a stroll from the footprint. All of this is going to be very hard to do, I guarantee you, if 75 feet of sediment is being laid down every day. And sure, again, you have evidence from the fossil record here that those sediments were laid down over the course of many, many years, where conditions were quiet enough for the flamingos to do their thing and for the barbed plates to be able to build up as well. The other thing that we find is algae encrusted logs, which implies that the logs have been sitting in water for a while for the algae to accumulate on. If the log has been sitting in a region and over the course of one day it's going to get buried by 75 feet of sediment, again, it's hard to understand how the algae is going to grow on the log. All of these reasons lead me to believe that a far more reasonable explanation of what is happening to flood geology is to say that the barns and the sediments are forming according to contemporary ideas as to how barns and sediments form. Let me briefly go to coral reefs. You see what corals look like, both present-day corals and fossilized corals. These come from reefs. Here's a cross-section of a reef. I'll show in a minute how reefs form, but the structure of a reef is as follows. Basically, it forms a circular construction with a lagoon in the middle. Now, the interesting thing about reefs is that you find that the windblown side is a lot rougher than the leeward side. You also find that the outside of a reef is much rougher than the part of the reef that is in the lagoon. Well, that stands to reason. The outside of the reef that is being battered by the wind is going to have pieces of the reef broken off, and the corals, the little animals that build the corals, are going to have to work that much faster to support the reef. And as a result, on the windward side of the reef, what you will find is a lot of fragments of coral, some of which have tumbled all the way down to the bottom of the reef, as opposed to the leeward side, where things are more uniformly built up. And then on the inside of the reef, as you examine the coral in the lagoon side, you will find that that does not have the fragmentation that you find on the outside of the reef. Keep that in mind. Let me just mention briefly how coral reefs form, and then we'll see what this has to do with the measurement of age. Raises dry land above the sea level. As a result, the corals are able to begin to grow in the upper parts of the volcano. The thing to realize about corals is they can only grow in about 120 feet of water. They won't grow above the water because they need the water in order to survive. They won't grow below 120 feet because there's not enough sunlight. Corals build their shells by extracting carbon dioxide that is dissolved in ocean water, and they use that for their shell. They secrete the lime that the coral is made out of, and the whole lime then cements the coral together. Now, if the volcano doesn't move, if the height of the volcano remains constant, all you would get is about 120 feet of coral. However, certain boreholes have found fossilized reefs that are literally thousands of feet deep. Well, how do they form? Basically, what happens is the following. Once a volcano forms and becomes inactive, it has a tendency to sink down into the surface of the earth. As the volcano sinks down, the corals on top of the reef begin to do their thing and build up the coral reef to the surface of the water. Now the volcano sinks a little more, the corals build a little more. The volcano sinks again, the corals build again. And as a result of the slow sinking of the volcano and the building up of the coral, what you can find are coral reefs that are much, much deeper than 120 feet. One particular coral reef of interest turns out to be the coral reef that was on the island of Anahuac. Anahuac claimed the fame is that it was one of the places where a hydrogen bomb was exploded, the temperature of the U.S. In order to measure the structure of the island, a number of boreholes were taken, and as a result, they found that the reef was 4,610 feet. How does it form? The process that I mentioned. Here's the other interesting thing. There were enough boreholes taken to be able to recognize which was the leeward and windward side of the reef. Again, by looking at the fragmentation of the reef. Debris of reef material was found at the bottom of the reef, of this atoll. The reefs form an atoll, the semi-circular island, as you find in the South Pacific. And at the side, the bottom of this particular atoll, debris was found, which was clearly debris that had fallen off the side of the reef as a result of battering of the waves. Not only that, but at 300 feet, 1,000 feet, and 2,780 feet, erosion layers were found on the reef. And what that represented was periods of time when the reef stopped growing, either because the coral died, or because the volcano situated was no longer sinking, and you had a steady state situation where the coral was not growing, and the coral was continually being battered by the wind and the waves, and as a result, an erosion layer taking place. And in that erosion layer, I also found the remnants of plants that exist in dry land, along with the column of plants and trees that exist on dry land. So it means it's a column. The bottom was sinking, the coral were growing up to a point when they stopped. Then the reef got battered, but in the process of being battered, the plants and trees were able to gain hold on the top of the atoll and had a growing time for plants and trees. Then later on, the bottom began to sink, the coral began to grow again, and this part that was eroded then was covered by more coral. And three of these erosion layers have been found. Well, the height, as I said, is 4,610 feet. Let's see how fast corals grow. And if we know how deep the reef is, and we know how fast corals grow, all we have to do is divide the height of the reef, or the depth of the reef, by the rate at which corals grow. How do we find out how fast corals grow? So why don't we check out the corals? And corals grow anywhere from 2 or 3 millimeters per year, to the highest rate of about 15, 16 millimeters a year, or if you like, about 1/8 of an inch to about 1/2 inch a year is maximum growth rate. Let's take 8 millimeters as the mean. Kind of the average between the slowest growth rate and the longest growth rate. And what we find, if we take the 4,610 feet and divide it by 8 millimeters per year, we find that the minimum age of this particular reef will be 175,000 years. Now I say minimum. Why is it minimum? Because we haven't added in the time that it took for the erosion layers to occur. So the reef is at least 175,000 years old. This is how we talk. If you go to the Grand Bahama Reef and do a similar type of analysis, you will find that the reef there is about 750,000 years old. Now, one response to this is to say the following. The reef material was really dissolved in the water of Noah's flood, and then as the flood subsided, this material precipitated out of the water. But basically, the material that would be dissolved in the water is material called calcium carbonate, basically lime, or some of you may know it as calcite. The idea would be that this material was dissolved in the water, and then this precipitated as the flood water subsided. I think you can all recognize the weakness of that particular argument. First of all, calcium carbonate is not easily dissolved in water. And trying to dissolve all the calcium carbonate that you find in these fossil reefs in water and all the water on the surface of the earth, you just can't do it. The surface water simply will not dissolve that much calcium carbonate. Second, isn't it interesting that the precipitation of the calcium carbonate just happens to match a reef? Isn't it interesting that the precipitation on one side of this reef-looking structure happens to be rougher, representing the windward side, as opposed to the other side of the reef, which is smoother, which happens to represent the leeward side? Isn't it interesting that the reefs were deposited in such a way so that you would have a lagoon in the middle? In other words, isn't it interesting that the precipitation of the calcium carbonate from the water just happens to look like a real reef that was growing. That would be extremely interesting. But the precipitation of reefs out of floodwaters does not work. Now, basically, what you find here is a process such as been described, and therefore, I trust this data of 175,000 years for the Anna-Weedoff reef, as I would trust the data of 750,000 years for the Bahama reef. One final piece of evidence, since we're in the ocean, you might as well go to great depths. In the middle of the ocean, you find in the water various critters that grow. These are tiny critters that look a little bit like this figure to the right. This is magnified about 140 times. Now these, there's two kinds of tiny animals that grow in the middle of the ocean. Basically, they're like plankton. And one of them makes her shell out of lime, the same way as the coral reefs. Another kind of tiny animal like this makes its shell out of, not lime, but silica. Silica is just sand. And even in ocean water, you find very tiny amounts of silica, of silicon dioxide dissolved in the water. And there are critters that are able to pull out the silicon dioxide and make tiny shells of silica, the so-called radiolarians. And then you have another feature called the foraminifera, which are able to take carbon dioxide out of ocean water and form very tiny shells of lime. These items are very tiny. They live literally by the billions in the ocean. But like everything else, they only have a finite lifetime. Eventually they die. What's going to happen to the shell? The shell slowly begins to precipitate out of the water down towards the bottom of the ocean basin. However, they are so tiny that the rate at which the shell falls from the surface where it exists down to the bottom of the ocean literally takes hundreds of thousands of years. And the reason is similar to what I discussed concerning the tiny clay particles. As long as you have any turbulence in the water, the shells are going to remain floating in the water. But eventually, over the course of very long periods of time, this material is going to begin to rain down on the ocean basin below. And from modern measurements, what we find is that the rate at which this material accumulates on the bottom is about 1 inch per millennium. Now, the material that accumulates on the bottom looks like ooze, and it's called an ooze. These are the oozes that collect on the ocean basins, on the ocean floor. Some areas, these oozes reach 1,200 feet. Well, how are you going to get time out of that? Basically, it takes the thickness of the ooze, 1,200 feet, divided by 1 inch per millennium, and for a 1,200 foot depth, what we have is the time of accumulation being 14 million years. Now again, what I want to emphasize here is that you are not going to precipitate that much ooze over the course of 1 year. Two reasons why. First of all, as we talk about floodwaters are moving back and forth across the earth. They are disturbing the water in the ocean, Great Lake, there's a great disturbance that's going to keep these tiny shells from precipitating out of the water and falling down to the ocean floor below. Second, you are not going to be able to support these many critters over the course of 1 year in order to form 1,200 feet of ooze. Why? Because these things need nourishment. They also excrete waste, the way other living things do. And if you take all the foraminifers and all the radiolarians that are represented by this ooze and try to make them alive at one time, basically the seed would be choked with these things. And there are certain biological processes that just keep you from putting so many of these things together, of increasing the density of these things in the ocean water beyond a certain point. And hence, it is very unreasonable that all these things were alive at one time. These things have been alive over 14 million years,
and they've been slowly living, dying, and settling down to final days of the ocean basin. And this particular, as I said, this particular calculation is above anything else that we've seen. This comes out to about 14 million years. Well, what conclusion do I want to make? Well, basically, unless we're willing to change completely physical laws as we know them, then that would include astronomical laws, biological laws, geological laws, like small objects just filtering down through the water. Unless we're willing to do that, it seems to me that what we have here are very noteworthy evidences that the Earth really is more than just 2,000 years old. And I am perfectly happy with that particular conclusion. You've been very patient for a somewhat technical talk, but I am open to questions so you can get semi-technical answers to semi-technical questions. Yes, sir, Tom.
I want to get to the measurements.
Yeah, good question. How do we make the measurement that the oozes really took that long to accumulate? First of all, there are physical laws that govern how fast an object will fall through a certain volume of water, so-called Stokes' law. And the smaller the object is, the longer the time it takes to fall a certain distance. You can calculate how long it would take something like that to fall in the bottom of some ocean basins. We're talking about thousands of feet. So if you assume that the material down below really is the settling out of the material up above, then the material down below is at least as old as it takes the material to settle. We're talking about thousands of years here. Then what you do is with some of the deep diving submarines that we have, or the bathyscaphes that we have, you actually go down to certain levels and you sample the water. And you see how many of these things are in a certain volume of water. And if you know what the density of the material is, then from that and how fast it's falling, you can determine how fast the material is being built up. So it's a combination of theory, Stokes' law, and actual measurement of the density of this material in the water at certain depths. Now, the other thing I should mention here too is that when the oozes are of the line variety, the age that you get by using this method is really a minimum age. And the reason is, as the line shells sink down to higher and higher water pressure, they tend to dissolve. Not all of them, but many of them tend to dissolve. If they didn't dissolve, your ooze would be even more than 1,200 feet. But there are also other places where the ooze is made entirely of a silica shell, which does not dissolve. And for that, you use both Stokes' law and measurement of the density of the material as it is presently falling. They try to get an idea of both the rate of fall and the amount of material that is there. Admittedly, that assumes that the rate of fall has been constant, more or less. But that is not unreasonable, because your rate of growth, well, it assumes that your rate of growth of these tiny critters has also been fairly constant. Maybe sometimes it was greater. Maybe sometimes it was less. But there's a limit beyond which you cannot go, because basically the animals that are forming the shells would choke in their own way to get beyond a certain density. We see that even happening today. And so basically what you've got here is probably a minimum age rather than an average age. You have another question.
How do you find out how fast it's holding at the amount of water above it would be the same?
Yes, it would. It would assume that the amount of water above it is the same. The theoretical grounds for believing that the ocean basins really have not changed much in 14 million years. If we were talking about 200 million years, it would be a different story. But in some 14 million years, it wouldn't change that much. The critical factor in this particular calculation is the rate of accumulation. That depends more on the amount of material that we have in the seawater, and to a lesser extent, the rate at which it is falling. So even if it's falling through a slower distance, if the amount of material you have in the seawater is the same, the precipitation is going to be pretty much the same whether you are dealing with
big depth of water or narrow depth of water? Is it in the snow or the bog?
Yeah.
So you mentioned at the very beginning some data about cut light coming from Europe. You said that the distance measurements we make include a tunneling effect of light because they're made along the same path.
Right.
Just briefly describe how those distance calculations are.
So just briefly, when you do, out to about 300 light years, you can basically use triangulation. So it's basically a method of triangulation, where one side of the triangle turns out to be the diameter of the Earth's orbit. And with that, you can measure distances out to about 300 light years, accurately, maybe 200 light years, 300 light years plus or minus 50%, 200 light years maybe plus or minus about 10% or so. So let's have 200 light years. Within those 200 light years, you have several thousand stars of varying brightnesses. Now, the interesting thing about stars are that two stars that are the same color have the same makeup. So what you do is the following. Suppose within this 200-year distance, you measure a star that has a certain characteristic blue color. You know how far away it is, but you know intrinsically how bright the star is. Now suppose you measure a star that has the same characteristic blue color, but it's much, much fainter than this star is measured. That star is clearly farther away. Well, how much farther away is it? From a nearby star, we know intrinsically how bright this blue star is. We look at our distant star, and we see how bright it looks. There's a very nice law called the inverse square law that can tell you how far away the object is. And the inverse square law works as follows. If you move an object twice as far away from you, it will look one-fourth as bright. If you move it three times farther away from you, it will look one-ninth as bright. 10 times farther away from you, it's 100 as bright. And so the method to determine distances beyond the 200 light years is dependent on Tom Madd's so-called standard candle method. And what it amounts to is looking at the apparent brightness of an object and compare it to the intrinsic brightness, and that will tell you then how far the object is. This will take you anywhere in our galaxy, which means 100,000 light years. Then there are other stars that periodically get brighter and dimmer. The interesting thing about these particular stars is that there's a correlation between how fast it gets brighter and dimmer and its intrinsic brightness. So these stars can be used to determine the distance to galaxies that are several million light years away. And the way we do it, we look at a galaxy for a long time, and we focus in on a star that is getting brighter and dimmer. We measure how long it takes to get brighter and dimmer. We say, aha, I can use that star, because I know from nearby stars that if it's brightening and dimming at this rate, its intrinsic brightness is so much. But now I see its apparent brightness. Again, I make the conversion between the intrinsic brightness and the apparent brightness. That will take me out a few million light years. Beyond that, I can use whole galaxies and do the same thing with entire galaxies. I see a galaxy nearby whose distance I know. I see a similar type of galaxy far away that is much dimmer, whose distance I don't know. Again, I use the inverse square law. And you build out with galaxies out to 300 million light years. And then beyond that, you use what's known as the redshift. That will take you out. That is what takes us out several billion light years. Okay, what are every measurement has a certain air associated with it. Out to a few hundred million light years, the air is probably plus or minus 20%. Okay, so maybe you're not 100 million light years out. Maybe you're only 80 million light years out. Maybe you're 120 million light years out. But that air is not going to get you from 100 million light years down to a few tens of thousands of light years. That's basically how it's done.
Exactly.
I mean, somehow if you would have to assume it's something like this. Let me suppose we are here, and the star is here, and somehow we're measuring the distance along this path, but the light is really coming along this path. But it just doesn't work that way. You are measuring the distance along the path that the light is taking. And the distance that is measured by this technique is the real physical distance away from you, unless you want to deal with fictitious distance. Yes, sir.
Is it true that stars run a galaxy are moving away from us, relative to us, at a certain speed?
Yes.
Okay, if that's true, then we need a certain amount of time that it will take for it to get that far away.
Yes, that's true. That's true. I think what you're referring to is the so-called Hubble effect. We find that once we get beyond a few hundred million light years, all the galaxies that we see are moving away from us. And the farther out they are, the faster away they are moving. And if you know how far they are moving away, how fast they are moving away from us and how far out they are, then you can kind of estimate the age of the universe by dividing that distance by how fast the object is moving. And when you do that, you again come up with something like 10 to 20 billion years for the farthest object. Yeah. Yeah, good point.
And then, so then that's part of the Bible. Because the Bible speaks a number of times of God who stretches out the universe. But then there are other times when it has a participle, that he is the one who is stretching
out. Continuous action.
So you have that already suggested by the Hebrew word.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Thank you. I suppose now with the Hubble effect, it's a little easier to interpret that than what it might have been.
It wouldn't have made much sense.
Right. Very interesting. Thank you. Yes, sir.
You mentioned that Galindo fossilizes bottom of the same
They're not in the bars, but they are in the sedimentary material below the bars. They're in the 25,000 feet of non-bar sediment.
Do those cylinders have a experience that they not lost, or are the cylinders that we keep back there essentially become a top lost? Is it unusual for cylinder nesting sites to become a top?
That I don't know. That would be an interesting question. There's no a priori reason why they could not be fossilized. You could understand near the edge of a lake that you might get a change in the water level that covers the nesting site. If you don't have a lot of oxygen in the water level, in the water, then you're not going to have much decay of the nesting site, and eventually it would be covered with sediments and then fossilized. So intrinsically, there'd be no reason why that would not happen, but whether that process has been seen happening, I don't know. Other questions? Yes, as a matter of fact, that is happening because, remember Newton, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Yeah, the other part of that, does that affect the fact that revolution and rotation is something phenomenal?
Yes. Let me get to the first point. This bulge, the moon pulls on this bulge, which slows down the Earth. Conversely, this bulge is pulling on the moon, and what it's doing is, it's like a little bit like a slingshot effect, and it's giving the moon a little bit more velocity in its orbit, and hence the moon is moving farther out. And the moon, interestingly enough, will continue to move out, and the Earth will continue to slow down until the Earth is rotating once on its axis every 48 days, and the moon is revolving around the Earth once every 48 days. Now, the effect that you are talking about, the synchronous rotation, basically the moon always keeps one face towards us as it goes around. And the reason is it rotates once on its axis for every revolution around the Earth. And what is causing that is, even though the moon is solid, the Earth still does raise the tidal bulge on it, grossly exaggerated here. And whenever you have an object that is oblong and the gravitational field of another object that's fairly massive, the tendency will be for the oblong object to lock one face towards the central object. And that has happened over the course of
the long moon history.
The long axis, right. The long axis will lock along the line connecting the two centers. Well, thank you. Appreciate your attention. I hope this has been helpful. If you have any questions that you wanted to ask while I'm munching on some goodies downstairs, I'll be very happy to answer those.
I have one other question.
Sure.
the difference between a year of some 400 days to 460, whatever the maximum recorded there is, that's quite a difference.
Right.
Would that be an experiential difference for us physiologically because of, when we have, we're going slower when we don't feel gravity more. And eventually, if the Lord carries, the earth stabilizes at 45,
48, yeah,
I mean, days,
right.
How much,
day?
Are we going to be shorter and flatter?
Actually, if the earth is spinning faster and we're being thrown away from the center of the earth from centrifugal force, actually our weight would be slightly less in the past than what it will be in the future. I think the physiological effect is not going to be much as you change from 365 to 390 or 400 days, or from 400 down to 390. First of all, in terms of humans, for all the time that humans have been on the earth, the rate has been pretty much 365 days. But in the future, if the Lord tarries, I think what you will find is probably things would be a little depressing, because for 24 days, you will find 24 present days, what you will find is your location on the earth being in total sunlight, and for 24 days you will find it in total darkness, which will raise some very interesting psychological and climatic effects on the earth as well. Thank you very much.